Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist of Freedom Estate. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
This is Leslie Gist. This is the Gist of Freedom. You can listen to us on iTunes at www.blackhistoryuniversity.com. Tonight we have our very close friend to the show, Dr. Ishmael Griffin, a survivor of COVID. He's going to talk to us along with his friend, Bonnie Harrison, who is a therapist. So with that, I will now allow Ms. Harrison to introduce herself.
Well, again, my name is Bonnie Harrison. I am a licensed psychotherapist, and I'm based in Harlem, gladly. I've been working in the field for 35 years or more, well, since 1977. I function as a professor at various universities. I lecture, and one of the things I love doing most is training. I do that. I'm also a grief ritual facilitator, and so I go throughout the country facilitating grief rituals, primarily focusing, though, on the technology of indigenous spirituality. And right now I'm doing some interesting things. I have been for a while handling my practice virtually. So I have online groups, and I also see, in quotes, people that I work with on the phone. So COVID has opened that arena up like it's never been before, I see, because people are not able to gather and be in offices. So it's opened up, I guess, opportunities for a lot of home-based practices, people who wanted to do home-based businesses to do this work virtually. I work with a diverse population. I became most known in the 80s when AIDS was a pandemic. And the beginning of that, and my first cases were in 1977 when I was working in substance abuse. As a result of that, I was approached by some black, at that time they were called gay men, but we don't use that term that much in the black African American community. It's more some gender loving, but they're people who still identify as gay or lesbian or black, gay and lesbian. But that's the population that approached me because there was no one out here that was working with the population and addressing the issue of AIDS. It was not called AIDS then. As a matter of fact, at some point it began to be called SLIM, and then it became ARC, and then it became HIV at some point, and then progressed to AIDS. But this pandemic reminds me of it. People say it reminds them of it. I ended up being chosen to be the chairperson for the mayor's task force on mental health concerns for the LGBT community under Mayor Dinkins, and I think it was Koch too during that period of time. And so I've done a lot of things in our community. I was the first coordinator for the HIV Care Network in Harlem. And so my work has sort of come full circle. And I'm really so happy that you asked me to be on this show tonight, because I'm talking not just about COVID and its impact on the black African American community and mental health, but also the issue of grieving, because what's happening now is so many people have not completed the grief process for HIV and AIDS, and now they're being impacted by COVID-19. So I'm looking forward to our conversation tonight.
Right. Thank you. And Dr. Ishmael, could you just give us a brief overview of what, you know, what you experienced in the hospital recently. And I know you didn't, you wanted to keep it private, but you accepted my request to come on the show to talk a little bit about it.
Okay, Leslie, again, I'm Dr. Ishmael Griffin. Somebody, I want to say at the outset that I'm honored to be on the show with Bonnie Harrison. I know Bonnie as a colleague, a mentor, and an advisor. And I can't say that my history goes back to 1977 and the beginning of the HIV epidemic and advising the mayor to be more. I can't say that my history goes back 37 years as a black mental health provider in New York City. I am just kind of awed, and I've always been awed by Bonnie and the work that she's done. Me, myself, personally, I'm this world he gave us. Probably a couple of weeks back, I was working directly in a I did one show when I was on my show to the emergency department. And you know, I interviewed a lot of patients. I interviewed, you know, a lot of COVID patients. I personally took the test. One video was negative. And I went back to work, and I was interviewing patients. Went back to work, and one day at the end of a trauma shift, started feeling some aches. I kind of knew automatically, given I thought they were about to get the patient, but they did not. I spent 5 days in the hospital, and I turned around. I had what is known as a cytokine immune response. Thanks be to God, my stats came back normal. And I was discharged home. And bring all this hate and war to an end. I'm a survivor of COVID. I'm waiting my last negative test to be cleared. And so I not only know COVID from the aspect of can say that I lived through it as a victim of COVID that survived. So some of my comments may reflect that understanding, that personal understanding. I'm just going to this is a great moment for me to basically lay it on the line with this Bonnie Harrison and the wealth of information on black mental health. It's a brand new day. Here we go.
Brand new. Tony,
that you received a phone call while you were in the hospital. Could you share that with the audience? Because this is Sunday, we're trying to make the show as uplifting as possible for those who may be in the hospital and listening, or they may know someone who's in the hospital with COVID. Your story is so inspirational, so if you could share that.
As the cold over the time of harvest, and so is a faithful message. I got the feeling that the medication that they gave me weren't doing anything. I think the thing that turned me around is I got a call from my aunt, 86 years old, and she prayed for me. And she exhorted me to get up. I was kind of in a state where I was a little tired and exhausted. I couldn't visit clearly, but I could hear her voice ringing. I know that it was really my aunt's prayer that brought me through this. It was really, you know, that connection with Christ that she has had that really connected with me, and I heard her voice, and that's what gave me the strength. I mean, I think that's what turned on the cytokine and immune response, and that brought on me just getting back up and fighting for my life, knowing that that COVID was not going to take me out. And that's just the truth of it. I've had a chance to speak with my aunt, and I told her the significance of her prayer with me. But, you know, thanks be to God, I'm here.
Thank you. And with that being said, please do not stop praying. There's a lot of gospel songs out there that we can sing, and they all say the same thing. Don't stop praying. So, Miss Bonnie Harrison, we discussed yesterday several topics. I like to talk about ways that, you know, we wanted to make sure we can memorialize our people, the lost, because on television we get daily reports of how many people died, and they just dismiss it as a flattening of the curve. But at the same time, it's a great thing that we do have memorials, or we pay tributes every night at 7 o'clock in New York City to doctors, courageous doctors like Dr. Ishmael, with the applause and things of that nature. You were discussing the way that we can also take time every day, and I loved how you explained high noon, to acknowledge those that didn't survive COVID, or to pray for those who are going through COVID. So I'll let you jump right in.
Well, what I would like to do is just reference something that Ishmael said about the strength that he got from the prayers of his grandmother. And so much of my work involves ancestral inheritance and ancestors, because part of my reality involves indigenous spirituality. So I think that the thing that has held, the glue that has held our people together, as well as people from other ethnocultural groups, but specifically our people, has been the fact that we have grandmothers and we have aunts and uncles and cousins and we have nephews and grandfathers who believe in the power of prayer. And being Americans, that is the basis for our survival here. Even though there are various interpretations of the Bible, there are various understandings of Christianity and various forms of it, the central theme has to be, at some point, I think, people recognize the power of prayer, if nothing else. And what does that person do? How do they grieve when they're unable to use anything that they've been taught to do? There will be no funeral. There's not going to be a wake. There won't be a repast. There's not going to be any sit shiva. There won't be any washing of the bodies as they do in Islam. No calling of the Adhan to bring people together. There won't be any last rites as they do in the Catholic churches. There won't be any goodbyes the way we are accustomed to having that experience. So what is happening is our people are, in a sense, losing it, are just becoming numb. And what happens when people are not able to grieve appropriately, maladaptive behaviors show up. People start drinking again. People that had clean time, many years of clean time, are now relapsing. You find the NA groups and AA groups are working overtime. They've gone to social media to help each other hold it together. You're finding people acting out of these goals of misbehavior because they don't know anything else to do. So the rage and the pain and the anger and the shame that people carry because I wasn't able to bury my mother. I feel ashamed because I wasn't able to. My relative is in a pine box, and we're accustomed to having maybe beautiful coffins, if there's such a thing. So all of the things that are familiar to us, we're not able to do. And we haven't been taught how to do anything else. So we displace these emotions sometimes in unhealthy ways. We drink, we use drugs, other forms of drugs, more than we normally would. We eat more than we normally would. We have a need to be nurtured, and we have a need for intimacy that gets displaced into sexual behaviors and acting out. The rage that we feel that comes from the anger that we feel because we could not do what was familiar, that gets turned into externalized rage. So we are now, people are beating up relatives, they're beating up their spouses, and they're beating children and sexually abusing children. Poor little kids that were able to escape some of this stuff in the household when they could go to school, they can't do that now. There's no school. There are no daycare centers.
Ms. Harrison,
people aren't able to go to work.
Okay. I just have a quick question I wanted to jump in there. I included in the post on the show a brief blurb about the Hart Mass gravesite. Would you like to talk
Leslie, can I say something before that?
Yes.
First of all, my aunt is Afro-Caribbean. She's from Jamaica. And I'd like to say that I believe that black people in the Caribbean experience the same form of torture. I think that there's a myth in this country that they have not. And so I see that border as very fluid. In fact, blacks from the Caribbean were oftentimes sold into the United States and back and forth. So I want to just say that at the outset. Second, what I want to say is that CDC has put out some statistic that 30% of the cases of COVID are actually amongst African Americans. And I think that many of the things that Ms. Harrison said are the background. I mean, there were things in the African American community that existed, including lack of access to health care, that made us particularly vulnerable to COVID. And I can tell you right now that there are cases of people, because I personally get phone calls, who they haven't counted as COVID, who died. So we have to understand that our community is being particularly impacted and that we need to have conversations about what's going on a personal level. I think what Ms. Harrison is saying about, you know, people having loss. I mean, we experienced in this country during slavery people that were just taken away. You didn't know where they went, and the grief and the sense that you never saw that relative again because they were sold off. You mean, never knew what would happen to them when they died. And I think that what Ms. Harrison is talking about, genetic memory, we all have a little bit of memory of that in us. And so when we see relatives going to hospitals, we can't really connect with them, and they say they're isolated. And then you hear that they died, and their body is isolated because, you know, is, you know, they, you know, suspected infectious from coronavirus. It affects us in a different way. And in, even in ways, basically in the deepest part of our souls that we don't understand. And so I just want to echo what Ms. Harrison is saying, and let's go on.
I agree with you. I agree with you that slavery impacted us, diasporically. And I agree too that the results of that experience are embedded in all of our in cellular memory for those of us in the Caribbean and in Central and South America, as well as on the continent. I think and I'm not going to get into the nuances, but there is a difference when you are colonized and when you are experiencing a neo-colonial experience, and when you are enslaved and not colonized, and not, but you have a colonized mind because of the domestication you experienced in America, which was different from the way slavery happened in some of these other places, as horrific as it was. But Hart's Island, for example, as you're talking about, is a place where people were buried, are being buried now, but it has a history that is indigenous to us as a people. And as a matter of fact, there's a monument there now that was erected for the purpose of recognizing those individuals that were buried there. But the African experience of burial was one of absolute respect and honor. and celebration. So for us, when our people's bodies are thrown in bags, stacked on each other, on top of each other, like meat in a warehouse, and it just so happens that people are stacked like meat in warehouses in these refrigerated trucks, then at a certain point, they are taken, if the time passes for people to be, the bodies to be claimed, then these individuals are taken to Hart's Island, and they're thrown in these holes, and dirt is thrown on them basically unceremoniously, and that's that. What that does to the soul of a person that's the progeny of enslaved Africans is unimaginable. And at the psychic level, it's almost irreparable, that type of damage. So there's just so much to this this particular pandemic that is so different from what happened with HIV when people were dying. There was the shunning, there was the distancing, there was all of that. But you didn't have people thrown in mass graves. People could get bodies, and when funeral homes would bury them, when they would handle those bodies the way they were handled, differently than what's happening now. People are not even, that you take people, Christians, for example, most people in Western religious belief systems don't believe in cremation. But now, for the most part, most of these bodies are being cremated. That is a horrific experience for people who don't believe in that. So my thing is, then how do we grieve these losses in a way that brings us some resolution? And I'm saying that since we can't do it the way this culture says you do it, then what are we left with? We're left with having to do it from an indigenous perspective. We can't do it if we don't know about the indigenous ways, but those indigenous ways have to do with spirituality, not religion, so to speak. And so what I can talk about and what I talk about in my practice and help people with is creating grief rituals, creating ancestral altars, creating altars to represent and to honor and our dead. And that is a very simple thing. It's something, though, that for some people is difficult to do because they've been taught through their religious belief systems, and they have come to believe that to do this is sacrilegious or it's demonic or it's bad. And it's not, when you think about the fact that I don't know any black person that at some point doesn't have a conversation with a dead grandmother, a dead aunt or uncle or sister or brother or great-grandparent, because in our culture, those grandmothers and uncles and aunts raised a lot of us. So they're like our mothers and our fathers, and we have conversations with them all the time.
Let's say something. Black culture is basically a culture where there's a respect of elders, and there's a sense of a connection and a sense of obedience to elders. So what's going on in terms of vilifying elders is kind of not really the way we kind of deal with things. The idea of having an elderly grandparent, aunt, uncle in a nursing home that's stuck in it that you cannot connect with or a parent is horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying. And I think one of the things that is unique about this discussion is that most times there is no vehicle to talk about it. You know, there is no vehicle for us to, and a lot of times black people aren't really aware of some of the cultural things that they know on a spiritual and innate level, but they can't really express. So I thank Ms. Harrison for being on the show, because she is educating us to these things that we kind of instinctively know, but I don't think that there's a communal discussion about this kind of understanding of grief in the black community. I think that we've kind of been short on understanding how we deal with grief. I've been in the emergency physician for 20 years, and I work in a setting in which it's trauma critical patients, and I've seen black people deal with death. And I can tell you that most time there are outbursts. There's a lot of emotion around it. It's just what I see. And then I see one person in the family who's the organizer, who basically has to deal with the process of the initial outburst. I've seen the bodies lying in the emergency room. I've seen people walk in, and I understand. I can tell you that a lot of times that when we walk in and we see that body in the emergency room, that there's a complete disconnect. Like we're seeing the body, but we're not really understanding that it's there, and we're grieving deeply, and we're thinking, you know what I mean, and they're outbursts. And then there's that one person in the family that organizes so that the family can leave. I mean, even just leave. You know, it's hard for them to kind of see the body lying there. We're talking about taking it down to the morgue and leaving. And what I usually have to do is I usually have to identify that person in the family who's going to organize. And it's kind of interesting that we're talking about this because I've seen grief directly. You know, some of the things that I've seen, I can't even talk about. But what I want to do is I want to let the show go on, and I want to let Ms. Harrison speak because I think what she has to say is very significant.
Well, I just want to just stop a second and just tell you that I applaud you. You are not the usual common doctor. The average doctor is trained to be very stoic and to disconnect from their feelings so that they can get the job done. And that's kind of like the male European Western way of doing things. But I find that someone like you and there are other brothers like you too and sisters who, because of your black experience, which is very connected to your culture through your grandparents and your elders, you're able to feel these losses in a way that translates into your thinking about your own family, your own family system, and finding ways to try to buttress some of the pain that family members and friends experience. I know you do that. You do wellness calls and checks. You would do wellness calls.
So what I'm saying is that I'm seeing in the media a lot of people calling health providers heroes. And I want to say at the outset that, honestly, I am no hero. You know, I came into this to take care of people. I relate to all people, and I try to do the best job I possibly can. I wouldn't be so vain to have gone into medicine to be a hero. I am a doctor. I have the same concerns because I've been personally affected by COVID. I have the same fears of people. When I go into the hospital, I can honestly say that I relate mostly because of just a cultural thing to African-American and Hispanic communities, because Hispanic communities, particularly those from the Caribbean, because I see a commonality, and a lot of times I see what they're going through, and I relate to them on a personal level. So, and whatever way I can, I bring that personal experience. Like when I'm talking to families that are grieving, I have to bring a sensitivity. One of the things I say when I'm talking to families, and particularly if they have a relative that is very sick, is that my white jacket doesn't touch the ground. That my job is to do the very best for them. But one of the things as a man that's raised spiritually is that I'm not trying to pretend to be God. So I don't call nothing. They ask me, I say, listen, we're working on getting them better. And they often ask, and then I say to them, I say, you're in here, your loved one is inside, you're struggling. I said, the reality is you're going to have to think the most positive thing. And so they look at me and they say, doctor, you're right. So I said, just stay there. That's, you know, I'll let Ms. Harrison take the rest of it. But I wanted to say those things because people have sometimes misunderstood how, you know, health providers may look at it. If the health provider is standing above you thinking that they're greater, then they think they're heroes. But if they're down there with you and they relate to you, then it's not about heroes. It's about relating to you and wanting and praying for the best health for you and your family. So I think that's the one thing I need to say, and then I'll let Bonnie kind of carry on because she's
One quick question before we pass on to Ms. Harrison. The insurance companies, which are greedy, they're finding that a lot of the patients are becoming, they're responding to religious rituals, the presence of their worship leaders, and they're finding that this is helping the patients, therefore save the money. Are you finding this to be a trend that they are now embracing, the involvement of the religious leaders to come into the hospital before surgery? Because I read that before surgery they're allowing people to come in and pray because they find out the people recover much quicker and they have better results with survival rates.
Let me answer that. I have a good friend. She may have been on the line. Her name is Dr. Kim Best, and she actually has a program of training for clergy that go into the hospitals. My kind of protocol with clergy is that I understand their importance, and I give them full rein. I let them come in and pray with their people because I understand the importance of that in getting better. Now, I don't really know if the insurance companies, what they know, but I know what I do because I've got to be about people getting better. So if Dr. Kim Best is on the line, I think that she has a lot to share about her program that she has had for many years. A wonderful woman who is a leader in the community, who is a esteemed colleague of mine and a friend. I'm going to share with you that there are two women that I call almost every day in the midst of this epidemic, and that's Ms. Bonnie Harrison and Ms. Kim Best and Dr. Kim Best. And so with that, I'll let Bonnie carry on.
Okay. And I think this is a perfect question for you, Ms. Harrison.
Well, I remember the days. Oh, this! I feel so old when I have this conversation. I remember back in the 80s when the hospital over in the Bronx incorporated indigenous spiritual leaders into the wellness program because they discovered they had a heavily Hispanic population in the Bronx, and this is like the South Bronx. Lincoln Hospital was where it was. And they discovered that when the Babalawos and the priests and priestesses would come to visit and do what they did, there was a complete change in the attitude and the wellness rate of the individuals that they ministered to. So it was no longer just the Christian minister that could come or the rabbi that would come. Now they were allowing indigenous leaders to come into the hospitals, and so that made a difference. One of the things that I wanted to do and am in the process of doing is creating a national process that not only Black African Americans and Caribbeans and diasporan people can relate to, but people of all ethnocultural groups, because believe me, in spite of the fact that the person that we have in that house in Washington has stirred up the ugliest underbelly of racism that we've seen in a long time, and it allows certain people in the population to act out. It's just like in group process, we have something called the scapegoat. And the scapegoat is the person in the group that acts out, says crazy things, does crazy things. And the moment the therapist tries to redirect that behavior, the group will attack the therapist. You know why? Because the scapegoat is articulating the thoughts and feelings of the group that is unable to do that for themselves. So that's what is happening with our president, who is functioning as the scapegoat in the group, and the population that aligns themselves with him, who are don't recognize yet how this is going to affect them. They really don't, because they get more welfare than anybody else. They get more Medicaid than anybody else, more food stamps than anybody else. So what's going to happen is they're not going to be able to have those benefits. They're not going to be able to work. They haven't been able to, and they're going to be in serious trouble. But the point of the matter is, how can we, as professionals, as caregivers, as caring people, come together and co-create in community a safe, respectful way for us to mourn our losses, mourn our dead? And what I created through the organization that I represent, which is called CITIS, S-I-T-I-S. It stands for the Sankofa Institute for Training and Integrative Services, Inc. It's a nonprofit organization here in Harlem. And what I created was something called Isonu, I-S-O-N-U. Isonu is a Yoruba word. It comes out of Ifa, and it means loss, you know, great loss. And I created an entire day whereby we go through a process of mourning and celebrating the life of these individuals. And it's not just people that we've lost. There are people we have here in this country who are from the Caribbean, Central South America, who are from the continent of Africa, who cannot go home, because if they do, they can't get back, and they need to stay here to help their families. There are people who have lost. I have friends who lost members of their family in the mudslides in Haiti, and they're here because their families need them here, and they're becoming doctors and they're becoming professionals to be able to help their own people. But that loss is tremendous for them. We have people that have lost jobs, lost relationships, lost limbs, lost so many things, and these losses need to be honored. So Isonu is an event, a community event that I've created, and I would like to, and we had planned to have this, Sankofa, CITIS, had planned to have this in the summer, in July. But now that COVID has hit us, what I think we need is to have at least a national day of mourning. And it needs to be structured in such a way that all religious groups and all faith groups, all indigenous groups can participate. And I had planned for next month to have a Zoom meeting, and I'm having people that represent these different indigenous cultures come on and co-host with me to talk about ways that people grieve death and dying in their culture. So what I would hope we could happen if this program is far-reaching enough, and people like an Oprah Winfrey or people like Henson.
Taraji
Henson, who is very much involved, she says, in mental health, particularly with black males. She's someone that I think she and I need to talk, because she created this foundation because she didn't see where there were any black therapists that could work with black youth and children, and she wanted someone for her son. But there are those of us out here. I'm here, and she's on the West Coast, and I'm on the East Coast, so she doesn't know about me. But what I would love to see is people like her and the Oprah Winfreys and the Tyler Perrys get involved in this conversation that we're having and support us in having a national day of mourning and recognition and celebration to address the issue of grief and loss around COVID. Because I think there are people in our audience who... First of all, do is they can go to our website. It's CITIS, S-I-T-I-S, Inc., org, S-I-T-I-S, Inc., .org. And you can leave messages and comments on the website, on the page. And there is also a number that people can call if they'd like. What I'm going to do is I'm going to set up an independent number so that people can call that number, because we're getting a lot of requests for participation. And what I'm going to do is post on the website a number that people can call, and they can leave information, they can ask questions, and they'll get responses, because I would like to see us have this as a collective community effort. I don't want Bonnie Harrison and her organization, CETUS, and Dr. Griffin and you to be the sole originators of this healing process. It has to be a community process, because our losses are a community loss. So if any of you out there in the listening community know anyone out there who has the ability to support this kind of work that we are doing, support such an event as an Isonu community gathering, who have television time, who have money that can help us do this, then please go to CETUS's site, list that information, leave your contact information, and we will get back to you. But in the meantime, I can give you this phone number that you can call. It's 646-651-3017. Again, 646-651-3017. And I will get back to you as soon as I can. But I think that we need to get together and have unity of purpose, unity of identity, and we can do this. We shouldn't even think about just a day. I think that we have losses all the time, every day. And I would like to show people how you can honor those losses on a daily basis. And we can decide, because it's universal, usually high noon is looked at as a spiritual time. So my vision is that at high noon, on the day that we choose, we're going to have this Isonu, and it's going to be national. Then it could be international, because the losses are international. I know here where I live in Esplanade Gardens, we had on Easter, we had a day of mourning and recognition, and it was so simple. We had a DJ to play gospel music downstairs. It was not representative of all of the cultures and all of the belief systems of people that live here, but the majority of the people that live in Esplanade are Christian. So there was music, and we did something as simple as just wave white cloths. I had a pillowcase, and it flew out off the terrace, and I got a face towel. But I was waving. We waved these flags in submission to a higher power. We waved these flags in honor of our dead, and that was so simple. That's something simple to do. So I'd love to teach us how to do other simple things at home and every day, and that way we will be able to go through this grieving process in a healthy way. People are not going to get stuck in these emotions and act them out in unhealthy ways.
Whatever the lot, come you stop praying?